Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
I'm Grace Bonney of After the Jump, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, I'm Linda Palaccio, and you're listening to A Taste of the Past here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Were you a Gerber baby, or maybe a Beechnut baby? Do you even know? Were you breastfed? Sorry to get personal. Were you breastfed? Maybe a lot of that has to do with your food taste preferences today, or your health. Who knows? But Amy Bentley, my guest today, certainly has done her research and has a lot to say about it. She's written a new book called Inventing Baby Food, Taste, Health, and the Industrialization of the American Diet. Amy is an associate professor of food studies and a food historian at NYU Food Studies Program, NYU Steinhardt. And she has really opened many people's eyes, I think, to not only the industrialization, not only baby food and the industrialization and commercialization of baby food, but industrialization of food altogether. And we all know processed foods are the evil bad sort. Amy, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Linda. It's great to be here.
You give a nice history, you know, very concise history of baby food, because it wasn't always available, certainly not in glass jars, wasn't always available pre-processed, people to grab it off the shelves before it was disdained. Tell me a little bit about the timeline and the history of commercialized baby food.
Sure.
Industrialized.
Commercial baby food, mass-produced baby food, got going in the 1920s. Before then, babies were fed recipes of gruel or beef broth, beef juices, sometime between 9 and 12 months of age. And
Pablum, things you would think of as baby food. Right,
but it wasn't really a specific category of baby food. It was a category of soft food meant to be fed, meant for babies, invalids, and the elderly. Mm. So it was kind of a larger category. And babies were fed those foods quite late relative to what it becomes and what we think of as soft babies being fed soft foods.
So it's quite late, you would say, probably by 9 months, 6 months,
a year. Mm-hmm. When teeth appear was kind of the idea. And then fruits and vegetables were not to be fed until after 2 years of age. There was some suspicion about fruits and vegetables. They had some laxative effects. It was not clear to people whether they were the carriers of dysentery or cholera. And so there was just some distrust about fruits and vegetables.
Harking back to the medieval times.
Exactly. And there, before vitamins were discovered in the early 20th century, it was not really thought that they had important food value, at least compared to grains and meats. Mm-hmm. Then in the 1920s, you have the mass production of canned goods, the development of manufacturing, processing facilities for canned goods. And pretty quickly after that, baby food as a category of canned foods begins to be developed. It starts with a man, Harold Clapp, in Rochester, which was a fruit and vegetable manufacturing area in upstate New York, and then really got going by the Gerber family in Michigan.
Who could not know about the Gerber baby? I mean, those iconic pictures of baby food ads. I mean, amazing.
Absolutely, and that actually started as a pencil sketch, and just caught the fascination and imagination of the company as well as the general public, and that icon just became indelibly connected to baby food and. It's one of the most widely recognized brand icons in the United States today.
Oh, interesting. So the baby food was produced in cans, I mean actual cans, and not what those familiar little jars,
right,
that we know.
Yeah, Beechnut actually did start in producing his baby food in glass jars, but Gerber, Klapps, Libby, some of the others started in tin cans. About in the 1950s, they switched to glass jars.
And interesting, you talk about, I don't know if anyone listening has ever really opened a jar of baby food and tasted it. It's changed a lot over the years.
It has. Baby food in the beginning was produced the way all canned foods were produced. That is, they were prepared with sugar or salt, preservatives, stabilizers. If it was a meat product, it often had nitrites in it, often had MSG in it. These are ways to maintain the integrity of the product, to flavor the product. When you process canned foods, sometimes you have to process it at very high heat, which changes the taste and the flavor and the color and the texture. So all of
and it destroys some of the vitamin content,
right?
As well.
And so all of these things are added back in to stabilize the texture, to enhance the flavor in one way or the other. And that was seen as modern. That was seen as scientific. Canned food, processed food, in the beginning was suspect, but very quickly in the early 20th century, Americans came to trust that, and advertising told us that that was scientific and modern and clean, and it was better than we could prepare in our own homes. And so these additives were seen as part of that scientific modern process.
Well, it's interesting because it kind of coincided, not kind of, but it coincided, as you state in your book too, with the discovery of vitamins and nutritional content, things that had never been really talked about in terms of food before. There were, you know, good foods, bad foods, but then they didn't know why. So vitamins were discovered.
Absolutely. In the 19-teens and 20s, you have the isolation of vitamins. So all of a sudden, fruits and vegetables have really important nutritional value that was not so recognized before. And you combine that with the mass production, with the rise of advertising, marketing, with the specialization of pediatrics and registered dietitians as careers and organizations. And it creates a perfect storm for the promotion and introduction and use of baby food. And mothers took to it. Mothers found it as a product of convenience.
Oh, absolutely.
It freed them from the kitchen. It made them more mobile with their babies. They could take their babies out and have a stable jar of food that they could feed their babies.
Right. Talk about the baby food. Well, there are different things. Was baby food baby's first junk food, baby food out of a jar? But seriously, baby food has often been talked about, when you talk about it as a possible, you don't say it in so many words, but gateway to our taste for maybe too much salt or too much sugar. And there is also, we talked earlier before the show about Gordon Shepherd's book on neurogastronomy and how he states that even in the womb, babies develop possibly an awareness or flavors are comfortable to them or familiar to them.
Yeah, I mean, to really understand this, we need to back up and look at the industrialization of food in the longer perspective. So the industrialization of food is a double-edged sword because vastly increased and stabilized the food supply for Americans and for people all over the world. So for the first time, you had, not the first time, but you had a reliable, dependable, fairly inexpensive source of food all year round. And that's important. That provides a lot of food and nutrition value for Americans in a way that it didn't exist before. We got very, very good at producing industrial food. And a highly processed, highly industrialized food often has minimal food value or an excess of sugar, fat, salt, calories, and a more minimal nutrition content in comparison. So while it stabilized the food supply year-round, it provides a lot of cheap, minimally nutritious food in the food supply, and people of lesser means consume a lot more of that food. And so that becomes the problem, is when the bulk of the food that you're consuming is highly industrialized processed food with a lot of salt, sugar, fats, preservatives. Recent science research has shown that infants don't emerge from the womb tabula rasa, you know, blank slate with what kind of no taste preferences. Scientists have found that amniotic fluid has flavor and is flavored by the food a mother eats. So if the mother is having signature spices from her culture, the baby comes out sort of acclimated to that. Breast milk also is flavored by the food a woman eats. And babies come out with a acclimation or a preference for sweet, which makes sense. Breast milk is sweet. Sweet means carbohydrates and calories. And so evolutionarily, it makes sense that babies would seek out sweet flavors. They also have an aversion to bitter. So they come out with flavor preferences and experiences. What happens if we feed those preferences with highly processed industrial food, it only further acclimates infants to have preferences for sugar, and then salt, fat also is a preferred flavor, and less exposure to bitter flavors, rougher textures, a variety of flavors and textures that create an optimal source of nutrition and food intake. And so industrial food and baby food at mid-century, which had a lot of this stuff in it, primed or sort of helped further acclimate infants to seek out and desire and crave those industrial flavors
without the
and
nutritional impact that breast milk had for them. They were just these
right.
kind of empty flavors.
Right. And that's the other piece, that in by the mid-century, formula and solid food sort of becomes the substitutes for breast milk. As breastfeeding levels drop and the introduction of solid food comes at earlier and earlier ages. So at the early 20th century, the late 19th century, as we talked about, the average age of introducing solids to babies is somewhere around 9 to 12 months. By the 1960s, it's an average of 4 to 6 weeks after birth.
4 to 6 weeks. Wow.
So that's that kind of those baby foods that have the sugar, salt, preservatives being introduced at a very early age, earlier than the baby's body is physiologically ready, later research shows. And so that kind of displaces breast milk in addition to the use of formula.
So mothers were really being influenced by this convenience and commercialized.
Absolutely. It was convenience, but it was also a marker of being a good mother. Mm. As the advice and the practice changes over the years from the early 20th century to the mid-20th century and then the late 20th century, the advice about what to feed your baby and when to feed your baby changes. It dramatically drops in this mid-century period, and all about commercial baby food. But that's what being a good mother meant. That's what the information was telling women. That's what advice was telling women. That's what advertising was telling women. That was scientific. That was modern. And so there was a lot of reason to feed your baby those foods, and a lot of sort of guilt if you didn't feed your baby. Because what if you weren't giving your baby the optimal nutrition, the optimal advantage? This advice and practice changes wildly, you know, in the late 20th century. But again, you have that same kind of anxiety. Am I purchasing the best things for my baby? Am I feeding my baby the right things? Am I being a good mother? The connection between love, nurturance, and food consumption and food feeding is so intertwined. It's just really hard to untangle those two.
And babies by nature sometimes can be picky eaters, or have, you know, they don't want to eat certain times. And so then there's always that fear that you're not, you know, giving the baby enough.
Right.
Forget what it is you're feeding. But, you know, they think, well, maybe it's the wrong, I'll try the pureed carrots instead of the pureed peas. Yeah. And really it's just, you know, listening to the baby's body.
Yeah. I mean, it's stressful because if it is a mother or a primary caregiver's obligation to feed that baby, right?
Yeah.
And so that's a big responsibility. And so there's no wonder that there's anxiety tied up in that.
You mentioned something about class. And initially, the baby foods, was it a class distinction too? Here was this commercialized, prepared food to feed your baby? Was that considered something of a privilege to be able to feed your baby this?
I mean, it wasn't the beginning when baby foods were more expensive, mm-hmm. but then they became cheap and some brands were cheaper than others. And it really, the use of baby food just really crossed the classes.
So they made it available to Absolutely. Everybody at that yeah. point and then really swept the market, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And at some point, formula. 90% of all babies were being fed commercial baby food. Mm.
I noticed it was interesting little fact that the American Dietetic Association actually used Gerber's name behind some of their research or recipes to assure quality. That's how trusted it became.
Yes. Gerber funded research that was then advertised and published in academic journals, received the famous Good Housekeeping seal of approval. It was just really a mainstream part of American consumption and food ways. It was naturalized, I say that in quotes. Mm-hmm. It was normal. It was what you did if you were a middle-class American.
Right. And then there was a shift in all of these additives, as you said. Something had to preserve it aside from that blast of heat that they would give it in mm-hmm. processing. But people started to become concerned about the added sugars and salts. When was that?
They did. In the late 60s and 70s, you start having a cultural shift. It's a shift away from the blanket trust in science and belief in authority. You know, that happens with Watergate, with Vietnam War, with all the turmoil that is going on in the 1970s. You get a shift away from what is called scientific motherhood, this trust in the authorities, to a ethos of natural motherhood.
Natural was the buzzword.
Exactly.
Right?
Trust yourself. Closer to nature is better. Science is suspect. And science studies actually were showing that an excess of salt, sugar, and fat in the diet probably wasn't that great in general. And, of course, that reached down into baby food and feeding studies for infants as well. And so all of these foods that were seen as positive and modern were beginning to be reevaluated. And infant feeding habits and practices were being reevaluated as well.
All right. Was there any correlation to, and maybe it was something that you touched on in your book, that some of the increase in the salts or sugars, parents or adults would taste the food and go, ooh, this is so bland, this is terrible, it needs more to it. Was it on the parents' perception, not the baby's perception?
Some of the research indicates that the baby food companies would argue, well, we have to add these things because the parents won't buy it, the mothers won't buy it. I think some of that was true. I also think a lot of parents didn't taste the baby food and just fed it to their child and trusted it.
Trustingly.
Exactly, because it was a highly regarded brand.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, you did a good job explaining scientific motherhood, because that was one of my questions. What do you really mean by scientific motherhood? Trusting science. Ooh, we have to be careful on that one. We're going to talk more about the evolution of baby food and what it means to us now as adults when we come back after a short break.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
We are back on A Taste of the Past. I'm talking with Amy Bentley, an associate professor of food studies and a food historian at NYU. And Amy has just written a book called Inventing Baby Food: Taste, Health, Industrialization, and the American Diet. I had to look at the front of the book. It's a long title there. Inventing Baby Food. We just keep it as a short title. All right, I'm going to ask you a little bit of a loaded, not a loaded question, but maybe a difficult question to answer. And so, you know, you've talked so much about how baby food has, affects the our preferences for taste in all the way up into adulthood, if not just into, you know, toddlerhood. Do you think there's any correlation between those preferences of taste and the additives in the baby food to what we saw in these people would now be in this particular area that we're talking about, the increased cases of obesity in this country?
Maybe.
I told you it was a loaded question. Maybe.
You know, there's so many factors that go into a person's health or a person's weight, a person's nutritional status. It's hard to tease out, and I certainly, as a non-expert, would not make a judgment. There are studies that point to kind of early feeding, overfeeding as an infant can lead to obesity and overweight as an adult or an older child. So there are connections. We know that the generation of baby boomers raised on formula and commercial baby food, you know, generally turned out okay. We have our health problems. We have our struggles. We have our issues. Diabetes is a big issue. Right. And heart disease. We have these diseases of excess, type 2 diabetes, because there's a difference mm-hmm. between type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Can this early feeding of infants have had a connection to those things? Yes, I think so. I think maybe what we can more strongly say is that kind of what we talked about before, that introducing those foods at such an early age kind of primes a palate to seek out and enjoy and find delicious those highly processed industrial flavors and textures. And so that's, I think, something that we can look to, and we can say, you know, so much of the population finds those flavors and textures delicious, and they aren't necessarily as healthy as other types of food, fresher, more fruits and vegetables would be. And how do we, how can we understand the palate in a different way, and how can we retrain people's palates, and maybe starting at infancy with a variety of flavors and textures at an appropriate age might be a good way to increase the nutritional value of people's diets.
All right,
just, I want to mention one more type of research that feeds into this, and that's some researchers in England have looked at infant food visually, not just kind of from a flavor and texture component. And they concluded that if all we feed infants are bland, soft foods, you know, rice cereal, applesauce, smush bananas, and that's what food means to them. Food is beige, food is soft, food is sort of bland or maybe sweet, has kind of a sweet flavor overtoned or maybe soft, salty. So is it any wonder that infants kind of primarily consuming those foods would move on to other beige-ish foods, plain pasta, macaroni and cheese, white bread, you know, noodles. Because food is not sharp flavors. Food is not bright colors. You know, those are the visual cues as well as the texture and taste cues.
All right. Interesting. Very interesting. Having been a mother during the 70s, I got caught up in that whole natural thing and what was the shift, mm-hmm. the whole, culture shift at that time. And one smart manufacturer made these little portable hand-cranked food grinders you just put on the table. You could take them to a restaurant with you. You could, not that that food was necessarily mm-hmm. the best to mm-hmm. feed the baby, but it's what, you know, many of us at that time used at home. We just cook, you know, without too much seasoning, cook food for the family and then just grind it up for the baby. That is, once again, we're seeing everything, as we do in history often, come full circle. Mm-hmm. And again, there is this embracing of more natural foods, wholesome foods, and people cooking for their babies at home once again. Not that they're not, you know, substituting, I guess, occasionally with those squeezable pouches, because those are certainly popular on the shelves, right?
Absolutely. Right. Well, so just in the 1970s, there was this consumer backlash to the state of commercial baby food at that time. And it forced the baby food manufacturers to take out a lot of those additives, the sugars, the mm-hmm. salts, and so it cleaned up baby food to a large extent. And there was just a whole imperative to make one's baby food, which still continues. You have the pouches, the boutique baby food manufacturers that have arisen today, which, you know, provide an interesting array and interesting options for women. And the pouches are just kind of one further indication of convenience. You know, they're just
shove it in the baby's mouth and
further,
squeeze hard.
Right, further convenience that has its pros and cons, I think.
Yeah. And of course, they all tout, you know, if not organic, natural, mm-hmm. natural, you know, foods. Well, salt's natural, sugar's natural. There's a problem.
Yeah, natural is kind of a fraught category.
It is.
We define it in the way we come to it, definitely. Yeah. You know, the latest kind of iteration of baby food is no baby food at all, kind of coming back full circle. And so there's a philosophy called baby-led weaning, where you just breastfeed to 6 months of age and then just start chopping up food.
Regular food.
And throwing it on the high chair, and then the baby kind of starts on, kind of more table food.
I'm observing my daughter with her child, and that's more or less what she and her husband have done, and talk about bitter flavors. I mean, I think more children are liking the sharper, bitter mm-hmm. flavors at an earlier age mm-hmm. Because they're introduced to it at an appropriate time.
Right? I think they are. And the American Academy of Pediatrics is all behind this. I mean, they are recognizing that there's really no scientific reason that refined white rice cereal needs to be the first food. In fact, there's a lot of good reasons why it might not be the best first food, and that you can substitute other foods for that. You can introduce signature spices. They're even changing their approach to allergies and the introduction of foods with regard to allergies. So there's really interesting movement going on in infant feeding at this time.
So something we should watch for, more developments in feeding babies. And baby food, of course, is, you know, the prime, you know, target initially. And we all, I think everyone has opened a jar of pureed, I don't know, apricots or something. What was your favorite? I love the pureed apricots.
You know, I have to admit, so I have three children and they all, you know, they ate baby food. I bought baby food. I made it. I did everything. I'm not sure I ever tasted it because it looked so awful.
I did. You know, it
Which
would
begs
be
the question, why did I feed it to my kid?
Yeah, right. I mean, I would grind the food, you know, diligently. I tried to be good about it. But every now and then, you know, you'd have those jars. I'd grab it, especially if you were on the go, right? And you're going to run and take something with you. And pureed apricots are my favorite, so I guess it became the kid's favorite. Of course, I would taste it. I wasn't going to give it to my kid without tasting it.
Yeah, well, you were a better mother than I was.
That remains to be seen. Amy Bentley, it was a pleasure. And again, the title of the book is Inventing Baby Food: Taste, Health, Industrialization, and the American Diet. So yes, if you think processed foods might be bad for you, read this book and you'll find out how bad.
Or good.
Or good, too. Thank you, Amy. And you've been listening to A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palaccio.
Thanks to
for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.